The R.R. Campbell Writes Cast is brought to you in part by listeners like you. Learn more about the great rewards available to Writes Cast contributors by visiting patreon.com/writescast. Thanks for listening. Well, hey, hi, and welcome to the fourth episode of the R.R. Campbell Writes Cast. For this episode, we feature James Y. Moore, who is the acquisitions manager at Immortal Works Press. He's also the author of titles including Theocricide and the Actuator series. Over the course of the interview, we have the opportunity to discuss the Immortal Works acquisition philosophy, explicit content in literature and film, book rating systems, and what we can look forward to from Immortal Works in 2017. I think James and I had a really productive conversation, so stay tuned for that, as well as some final thoughts after the interview has concluded as well. Before we get to the interview, though, I wanted to pass along a couple of updates about the podcast. We are now booked for about half of 2017, which still means there's a chance for other authors, agents, editors, writers of all backgrounds. Please, if you're interested in joining me for future episodes, you can contact me on Twitter at @IamRRCampbell, or you can also reach out to me by email. That is rrcampbellwrites@gmail.com. You can get in touch with me on Twitter or email, whichever works best for you. Let's get a dialogue started and discuss what might be some interesting things to talk about on the show. As you know so far, for those of you that have listened to previous episodes, we've covered action scenes with Dan Sciro, short form fiction with Dylan Davis. We'll have today's episode featuring James Y. Moore, and we have some episodes coming up that will talk specifically about YA. We'll have one talking about branding as an author, and we will have another future episode talking about the proofreading process. Really excited for those guests that are coming up in the future, and again, a big thank you to everyone that has been on so far. But if you are interested in joining on the show, if you think you have a good topic, if you have something that you believe you can speak to in the world of writing, please reach out to me. I'd love to get a conversation started and we can take it from there. That being said, let's hop into the interview we've got for today with James Y. Moore of Immortal Works, who joined me for this conversation via Zoom back in January. Thank you to James Y. Moore for being with me today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, why don't we start by telling listeners and even just bringing me up to speed on what it is that Immortal Works is and what exactly it does.
Well, Immortal Works is a publishing company, obviously. Mm-hmm. And so we, people send us manuscripts of books they've written, and we read them, decide, you know, if they're marketable or if they fit our mission statement. And then if we like them, we take them through the editing process, get a great cover on it, and publish the book.
Yeah, perfect. I mean, it sounds like kind of your standard, step one acquisition all the way through, you know, editing, publication, and all that, just like any other press would have. How long have you guys been up and running for?
Oh, only a few months, honestly. It's been since last summer that we had the idea. Jason King proposed the idea, and he kind of spearheaded the whole thing. I thought it was amazing how fast you put it all together.
Yeah, I mean, it's got to be an exciting atmosphere to kind of be working in sort of a startup situation. I'm guessing for listeners that might not be familiar, do you want to elaborate maybe on your history and what brought you into Immortal Works, for example?
Sure. I started, like, you know, most authors, I started writing way back when I was a teenager. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I dabbled a little bit in sending out query letters and trying to get published, but nothing really came of it, of course. And those early books were so terrible that
it's amazing when you look back on your stuff that you wrote years ago. I do the same thing. I look at it and I'm like, I was so proud back then, but wow, I'm really glad that it didn't make it to publication.
Yeah, there was no real chance that those were going to get published, so it's not a problem. Mm-hmm. But I did that, and then I went on a mission, a religious mission, mm-hmm. to Korea for 2 years.
Okay.
After high school, and then I came back and went to college, got married, had kids. But I always loved writing. I didn't have much time for it in college. Did a little dabbling here and there, but after I got settled in my job and I had a little more free time, I went right back to it and just. I've just pretty much been writing all the time since.
No, fantastic. I mean, it's good to know that it's always the thing that, you know, the thing that you come back to. It's kind of how I've found myself in my own journey, too, is it's like I started writing a little bit as a teenager, did it on and off in college, and it's actually been kind of since I've been done with school that I've been able to kind of come back and make the time and embrace it a lot more. So it's one of those things that, you know, I think as your story attests to, if the draw is there, the draw is there, whether it's, you know, role as an author or an acquisitions manager or even getting involved as an editor, for example.
Oh yeah. And I saw Terry Brooks once speak at a book signing, and he said, you write because you have to.
Yep. Absolutely. Yep.
And he actually said it in a funnier way where he said, if you can do anything else, do it. Because writing is a terrible way to spend your time. You spend so much work and so much time putting this book out. Mm-hmm. And the returns, although gratifying, are very small in terms of money or, you know, how many people actually read your book. It's seldom as many as you hope for. Mm-hmm. But if there are intrinsic rewards that make you, you know, have to do it, then it works. But if there aren't, then you should do something else.
Yeah.
I thought it was funny.
I would agree. I mean, it is one of those things that, like, you have to feel like you need to do it. If you have the stories to tell and you feel like you need to tell them, that should be the reason to write. And if that's the reason to write, that's perfect then. That's perfect.
Yeah, exactly.
So then,
anyway.
Oh, no. What were you going to say? Go for it.
Oh, I was going to say. So I was writing, wrote a dozen books or something, and I started taking more seriously the submission process. Mm-hmm. And I was actually submitting several books over a couple of years. And I had my first book, Theocracide. It was picked up by a small press in Virginia named Curiosity Quills Press.
Okay. I think I've heard of them, actually. Might have been on Twitter or somewhere. I might have run into them at some point.
Yeah, as far as small presses go, I think they're pretty big now.
Very cool. Well, that's cool.
But yeah, so I started publishing through them. They invited me to the manager, one of the managers there, Andrew Buckley, invited me to become an acquisitions editor. Mm-hmm. So I kind of did that on the side of writing, which I did on the side of my day job. And and that was fun for a couple of years. It really was. And then and Jason King actually was an acquisitions editor for them as well. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of how we met. And then he was just talking and he said, hey, I've got all these people. I have, you know, a business manager and I have all these people that said they're interested. I think we could actually make a business and make it work.
And then you have it. Get everyone in the same room and then one thing leads to another, right?
Exactly. Oh. And so we took the leap and started the ball rolling.
Yeah, now here you are. So very cool. Well, it's great when things come together like that, I guess. It's really nice and you can find people that are on the same page and have the same vision for things. And I guess that's really, I kind of wanted to hop into that because I know you mentioned earlier on talking about crafting a mission state for Immortal Works, or excuse me, a mission statement for Immortal Works. Why don't you speak to that a little bit, since that is something that I think I really wanted to focus on as part of this conversation.
Okay. Well, I believe that's the most unique part of Immortal Works. Well, besides the fact that we do every book that we publish, we also produce an audiobook for it, which for small presses is exceptional, I believe. But audiobooks are really the way things are going, so we feel like that's important. But the mission statement happened when I was having lunch with Jason, and he invited me to be, you know, the acquisitions manager, and we were kind of brainstorming what that would entail. And I told him that something that I'd been thinking about a lot off and on over the last year or so, and that is I've heard so many authors say they wrote their book thinking of a kind of wider range than just one age group for their audience. Mm-hmm. And so they may have written a book with a 14-year-old main character, but they really envisioned it as a book that would appeal to adults as well, or even kids a little younger than 14. And so after seeing some of them New York Times bestselling authors say the same thing over and over again, I told Jason, I said, I think there's a real desire in people to not be so striated by age in our society, especially books. And there's a lot of good examples that go against this. For example, Ender's Game, the main character is 8 years old, but it's an adult book.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's one that I know. I've got a buddy. He was actually also on the first episode of the podcast. Ender's Game was like, it was his childhood, but even as an adult, he continues to reference that, I know, when he's even discussing his own material, and I'm sure it's something that comes to mind a lot as he writes, so there is something to be said for transcendence, even if your protagonist is of an age that's very different than your own.
Right. Well, and we were all eight.
Yeah, exactly. We've been there.
It's not like, if I can imagine the future where faster than light or near light speed travel is possible, and these complex things that are in this story, these alien invasions and such, why can I not imagine that I'm 8 years old
again?
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no reason that barrier should exist. And The Hobbit is most often told to be a young adult book. Mm-hmm. It's classified as such, but the main character is 80-something.
Yeah, that is true.
You can't forget about that. These are fantastic examples, and so what we talked about and what kind of gelled was this idea. As a large press, as a big box, you know, publisher, you kind of have to play really hard with the market. You have to really follow and track these trends. But as a small press, we can afford to be a little bit more flexible. And so Jason really liked what I said, feeling the same way about his books. And so we decided, hey, maybe that's the thing that can make us a little bit different. Maybe this one little change of perspective will make Immortal Works memorable and more useful in the publishing industry.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, so it sounds like really it was driven by the desire to be able to, I don't know, present genres, or I guess in the way that at least the website pitches it, you know, you still have an opportunity to tell a gripping tale, but you don't want to mire it necessarily in content that wouldn't necessarily be approachable to readers of a younger age. Does that make sense? Does that seem like a fair assessment of it, I guess?
Oh, yeah, that's exactly right.
Okay.
And when we boiled it down, it really comes down to we want all of our books to be appropriate for teenagers and appealing to adults.
Got it. Okay, so it's a matter of really the idea is to kind of strike a balance and make sure that it is, I guess, approachable for that wider net of audience, of readers, maybe.
Right. Exactly. And it doesn't even seem that unreasonable. Most of the really big movies are written that way.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And I guess they do try to frame it, I suppose, in the, you know, they have a rating system, for example, PG-13, or it's PG or G or R or whatever. So they try and give you an idea of what to expect. But realistically, I mean, you think about animated films, for example, even though those are oftentimes visually geared toward a younger audience, I mean, it doesn't take, you know, much thinking on the matter to know that there's also some, you know, adult material in there that slips in, but it's still presented in such a way that it does not come across as, I don't know, what some might consider lewd or obscene.
Exactly. I mean, I love Adventure Time. I love
Gravity
Falls.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, those are great.
And I think that there is a kind of innate quality to good storytelling that transcends something so silly as how old the main character is, equaling the age of the reader.
Yeah, certainly, certainly. So I guess when Immortal Works is looking at to make acquisitions, does it keep in mind this sort of wide net that it's hoping to cast? I mean, does it select based on particular genre? Are there some genres it's simply not interested in acquiring because it doesn't feel as though it can necessarily meet those criteria? Or what's the approach from a genre standpoint?
Oh, that's a good question. Actually, we're not really selective about genre.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm.
If someone had a good mystery novel, we'd take it. If they have a good Western, we'll take it. We're less interested in the genre than we are the audience in that sense.
So is that something that then, you know, if you have, for example, if someone were to query one of the agents at your press and they aren't as familiar with the mission statement as one might hope, perhaps they didn't do as much research as, you know, you would hope they would do going into it. let's say they come to you and they've got this story and it's really something that your agent believes in, but it doesn't necessarily fall within the sort of guidelines laid out by that mission statement. What has that happened? Is that something that is that you kind of have an idea of how that situation would be handled and trying to balance a, hey, we really appreciate your story, but we'd also like to make sure that it remains approachable to all audiences sort of thing. How does that kind of come together?
Oh, that's good. We actually, I personally have mm-hmm. rejected several stories, which I thought were appealing stories and looked very interesting mm-hmm. from a reader standpoint, but that didn't meet with our audience standard. And I just said that to the people, not in a way that implied, you know, maybe you didn't read enough before you submitted.
Oh, yes, certainly. Mm-hmm.
This is a great idea, but it doesn't suit what we need in terms of audience. And, you know, in some cases, there are people who say, you know, I'm not really in love with having 14 F words in my book. Mm-hmm. I'm willing to flex that. But most cases, they just say thank you and move on. So, it you know, it's fine.
Oh, sure. So it sounds like in most cases, you know, a lot of folks, they kind of, you know, I think about it from my perspective as a writer. And I think I am, as a writer, I guess, not particularly opposed to maybe some situations. I feel like when I'm writing, they kind of call for that. They call for a curse word. They might call for violence that seems beyond the pale sort of thing. Do you ever find mm-hmm. do you ever find a writer, for example, who you've spoken with, after, you know, bringing them up to speed on the mission statement, has there been anyone that's been in a position where they think to themselves, you know what, actually, maybe I will go back and reconsider kind of the manner in which I've framed it? Or do you find that most of the writers that are in that position kind of stick to their guns, so to speak, and feel like, you know, my manuscript, I think I'm going to roll with it how it is?
Well, actually, we've had some of each. We've had some who say, oh, you know, I'm totally flexible. Mm-hmm. And in that case, And some that we're still working with in that particular situation. And that actually comes down to the acquisitions editors. Mm-hmm. So for me, I as the manager, I kind of pre-filter everything that gets queried to us. And I look at, you know, their writing samples a little bit and their letter to see if it matches our statement and if it sounds like something that's gonna go with what we want. And if all that seems up to snuff, then I assign it to one of our six acquisitions editors, mm-hmm. and then they request the full manuscript, read through it, and come up with it, you know, and decide whether they want to recommend it for publication or not. And all of our acquisitions editors are familiar with our mission and our audience guidelines. And so more often than me seeing something that isn't appropriate or that doesn't really work, they'll come back and say to me, you know, this is really written for adults. It's not good for us. And then they're having that conversation with the author. Or in some cases, you know, it's really written for teens, but it's not going to appeal to adults. And in either case, we just tell the author, you know, maybe you'll find a press that wants what you have. Most of the presses want very specifically geared to age appropriate, you know,
which makes material. Sense. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They want an MG that has a protagonist who's 14, who is, you know, going through middle school or grade problems dealing with that. Or they want a teen that's the right age that the teen readers will read, or they want an adult, you know, so if you wrote a book like that, it will probably find its audience somewhere else.
Yeah, absolutely. And that makes sense. I think and that's really the great thing too, is it's, you know, really important to be, I guess, upfront with an individual who might have that really enthralling tale, but doesn't necessarily fall within that mission statement. I think that it's really great to be able to leave room for both Immortal Works to stay true to its mission statement, but also for those authors who, whether they're willing to, you know, maybe pare back some of what they had written, or if they're willing to say, hey, there's definitely a place for what I have as it exists. I think it's good that there's an opportunity to meet in the middle, so to speak.
Right. And one funny anecdote related to this is one of the acquisitions editors said, he, and I don't want to be specific because I don't want the author, if they listen to this podcast, to feel like we're singling them out.
Yeah.
But he said it felt like someone had just done a search and replace for all the bad words.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm.
And since it was a sci-fi, it turned out to be kind of like Firefly, where they replaced all the words with something else.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't actually a bad fit. We didn't end up publishing that book for various reasons, but it was an interesting conversation.
Yeah, certainly. And I think that that's something that it would be worth even exploring as part of this conversation is, as you're working with an author who might be in a situation where they are, you know, for lack of a better phrase, sort of paring back maybe elements of their story to make sure that they're in line with the Immortal Works mission state, how does Immortal Works go about defining, you know, graphic violence or obscene language or pornographic content, for example?
Well, what we say is PG-13 and probably on the light side.
Sure. Okay.
Because people are familiar with the movie rating system, and I could give video game rating systems, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
But it's probably a whole other conversation to have, but I really wonder how books as a media have managed to evade any kind of rating.
That's actually a really good point.
Other media have been, I mean, there's all that book burning and banning and stuff issues that maybe helped it, honestly, once I had a friend who, at the time, I was writing a book about nightmares, and so she gave me as a present for Christmas a YA book that was about someone who could go into dreams and, like, do police work. And it was a really interesting book, but it was incredibly, what I considered to be incredibly inappropriate for a young adult audience.
Mm-hmm.
It had graphic scenes of sex in it, which I felt like wouldn't be something that parents would want their younger children reading, you know? I mean,
yeah, I feel like when you start getting into actual, and I think this is one of those things that just the market maybe tends to naturally sort out, is that once you actually cross the line sort of into like explicit sexual contact and things like that, I feel like it just naturally just has to leave being considered YA, you know? I'm not sure that, like, I think at that point, regardless of the age of the protagonist, I feel like you start, you know, crossing into new adult or just generally adult fiction, you know, that just seems like how it would fall into a different genre entirely almost.
Right. And I don't know. It doesn't, I mean, some people try to be edgy by pushing the boundaries, or mm-hmm. maybe that's really what they feel artistically they need to do. And that's fine. You know, I'm not trying to change what other people want. We at Immortal Works, we simply recognize that there's a large group of people who want their media to be relatively safe. You know, if you want to deal with issues, if you want to deal with stuff, then you have your teenager read Catcher in the Rye and you talk about the stuff with them or whatever. But if you want, you know, if you want to feel safe, yeah, it's okay for my kid to read this book, then that's a whole nother thing.
Yeah, I suppose it really does come down to, I guess you could call it a matter of venue or something like that, where if, for example, there is a book that's published by Immortal Works, it's kind of like, well, you know what you're going to get insofar as that sort of content is concerned. But like you said, there are those other outlets. There's your, you know, Catcher in the Rye. There's, you know, books like the one that you mentioned by the author that did have that explicit sexual content. I mean, the nice thing about the literary world, I guess, is that there are really, I feel, probably, especially with the advent of independent publishing, I mean, there are more options there than I think there are for any other kind of media. I feel like that's got to be just the case quantitatively, don't you?
Oh, definitely.
There are options everywhere, even if it's not like something that's published in a physical, you know, format. But even if you think about the explosion of fan fiction and the websites that are dedicated, you know, specifically to that sort of thing. I mean, there really is a market. I would say there are more custom tailored markets in the world of literature than there probably are in any other form of media.
I agree. And I believe that's partly because it is, now especially, it's so accessible to people who want to try being an author. What used to be prohibitive in terms of you had to afford a typewriter, you mm-hmm. had, or, you know, you had to have time, you had to have education level, things that, I mean, I'm sure there were always would-be authors in the world, but the bar was a lot higher to get into to get your work in front of other people's eyes.
Definitely.
It, If you didn't even actually think about somebody willing to read your handwritten manuscript, you probably didn't have any readers.
Yeah. Well, you think about even going back to an age prior to the internet when it was, you even had to go, you went to a library, you were able to check out a book on agents that were out there, agencies. You sent your physical manuscript to that location and it would be sorted through and read and what returned to you at some point. I mean, that process alone is so significant. It's that much slower and the resources aren't there to support as large of an industry as the one that we see now after the advent of the internet.
Definitely. Well, and I actually am old enough, no jokes, that I have sent physical manuscripts to people.
And that's the interesting thing to me is that you still see websites that insist, you know, if you're checking out a particular agent or what have you, that will specifically say, like, please do not send a physical manuscript, which is interesting to me because I feel like, and I don't, you know, I'm not looking to date you or anything, but I feel like the widespread sort of that practice as a widespread thing in the industry had to have ended a while ago, I would think, right?
For the most part, yes. And I'm not really, it's so expensive and cumbersome to print a manuscript and mm-hmm. wrap it and tie it or whatever you're going to do, tape it up, walk into a shipping location like a post office. I mean, it's not hard. It doesn't take hours, but it's a significant investment. In an electronic world, it just makes no sense anymore.
Yeah, no, it really doesn't. I mean, especially when the comparison is stay at the same keyboard you were at when you wrote the thing, just have access to the internet. You know, I glaze over I make it sound like the internet is a thing that everyone has access to. I wish it were the case that we did. But, you know, that being said, if you have access to the internet, it's a couple clicks away. It hits someone's inbox and it's there, the end. You know, that's so much time saved, even from something as simple as taking 15 minutes to drop something off at a post office, for example. So I suppose, yeah, I mean, it really has changed everything.
And imagine this. Imagine typing hundreds of pages on a typewriter that is an expensive device by the standard of the day. Mm-hmm. And you only have that one copy.
Yep.
I mean, physically in the world is one, and you're putting it in a mailbox. That would freak me out.
That would be terrifying. I just can't imagine how high my anxiety levels would be. I mean, it's nerve-wracking enough to, even when you get an email back from an agent that, like, suggests they're interested, I mean, that's an exciting thing, but it's also nerve-wracking because you're like, all right, if you're looking for more chapters, here you go. You send that off. That's nerve-wracking enough. But if you're sending off your only copy of that, my God, I can't imagine.
Yeah. It's a funny, it's great though. I'm glad the world has changed the way it has because I feel like more stories are getting told and a lot of the barriers that used to exist, like genre, for example, are coming down. Mm-hmm. People, you know, for a long time, science fiction was kind of this like underground hidden thing that only weirdos read.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, you read Westerns or you read mysteries. That's what there was. It's there's so much out there now, media-wise. There's so many different venues for literature. You could literally read your whole life away and never spend a penny.
No, certainly. I mean, yeah.
There's so much to read. And, I mean, even just if you went on Amazon right now, I could find 10,000 books that are free because some author or publisher is offering a promotion. I could download 10,000 books if I wanted to spend the time doing it right now.
Yeah. And then they sit on an e-reader and they're ready and waiting for you. I mean, whenever you want to get to them, I don't know if anyone has time for that many books, but you know, the point is that they're there. So that plays in perfectly to that.
Right. Right. But of course, most people agree that you get what you pay for and
yeah, that's certainly the case. Got to do your research. I mean, it's great that the material is out there, but that is, you don't have to spend too long, you know, lurking around the internet to find that it is certainly true. You get what you pay for to a certain extent.
Right. Yeah. Well, because the reason they're charging money, like the reason we have this press is because more eyes on the manuscript, more people invested in it, makes a higher quality story.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, different perspectives have the opportunity to come at the page before it's actually bound into a copy that, you know, is readily available to other folks. If I were to, you know, sit down and write my entire manuscript and click publish right away before I have an opportunity to share pages with a beta reader or run it through my critique group, I'm confident that what I would be putting out there would be something that is just not quite up to snuff. I mean, you know, one person can sit down and write a book, but it kind of takes a village to like make the book work, if that makes sense.
Right. And, you know, and some people, that's all they want. They wrote one book, they're kind of happy with it. They're not trying to make a masterpiece or to get rich. They just want to get their voice out there in the great conversation. And Amazon has made that possible for people, which is cool.
And then I think, you know, to kind of, I guess, tie this back into, because we're talking about that rating system. That was actually one of the questions I was going to ask, was like, where on the movie rating system does the Immortal Works stuff fall? It sounds like you said PG-13, kind of light on the PG-13. And then you brought up that point about how it's interesting that books don't have a rating system kind of like, you know, video games and movies do. And I actually, now that you say that, I don't know if I'd ever considered that before. And that is kind of a valid point. And I don't think it's necessarily something that is worth exploring from the standpoint of, you know, censorship grounds or safety grounds. I kind of wonder if the reason that it's not done has simply to do with the volume of material that's out there, kind of like we were suggesting. I just can't imagine what kind of, you know, panel or, you know, government or private enterprise would be able to sit down and rate what every book that hits the market.
Right. And we've actually discussed this a little bit, or I have with multiple different people. And part of the issue, I think, is, like you said, the sheer volume. However, just like with comic books and video games, what happened is people wanted it rated. And so if a comic book came out and it didn't have that little stamp way mm-hmm. back when, it's not the same now, but back when comic books were considered, you know, bad by a lot of society, mm-hmm. the comic book authority came out and the I can't remember what they're called, American Comic Authority or something. This group of people came out and you paid them. And they would certify your book met these certain standards that they had met, that they had written. Hmm. And then they would give you a little seal to stamp on your book. And if that seal was stamped on the book, then mommies and daddies could know that there's a limit to how much this book contained and that they were safe buying it for their little kid.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too. I guess I didn't realize that comic books, you know, had that. I think maybe part of the reason that there's a distinction drawn between, you know, comic books, video games, and movies versus simply words on the page, maybe that has to do to a point about the difference between passive and active media. Because when you think about it, video games, yes, you're certainly interacting with it. There's no doubt about it. Movies, it's very passive. You sit and it's presented to you. In comics, though, it requires engagement on the part of the reader. There are certainly words in there. I think maybe it has to do with the visual nature of it that has created that sort of clamor for a rating system.
Oh, I agree. It's possible for your mom to walk in and see your video game.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Or even just to know, like...
Or your comic book.
Yep, or even with a movie... There's always that moment where, God, what movie was it that I this is going to sound crazy, and even as I say it, I'm wondering if this was the case, but I feel like it had to be. I went and saw World War Z when it came out a few years ago, because I'd read that book. I thought the book was awesome. I really enjoyed reading that book, and I was like, I'll give the movie a shot. And I remember, I feel like that movie had to be rated R or something like that, but there was a mother who brought a young child into the theater, and even me, someone who is generally, I don't have kids of my own, so it might be something that I just don't understand because I'm not a parent. I'm very much like if you're comfortable with your kid doing something and you can speak with them about it, that's all fine and dandy. But man, that parent had to leave the theater with that child within the first 10 minutes of the movie. And it was just like, yeah, that was kind of a poor choice on your part. That's why the ratings are there, to help you make that decision about what is going to make sense for your kid, whether it's, you know, difficult material or frightening material or whatever it might be. It just seemed very... strange to me that rating system was sort of ignored in that case.
Right. Well, I'm trying to look it up really quick to see the rating. Hold on.
Yeah, maybe that one was just
I also read the book. Actually, listened to the audiobook. It was fantastic because it had a whole bunch of different readers mm-hmm. for the many voices.
Oh, that's really cool, actually. I can imagine that was a really neat one to do in that format. I hadn't thought about that.
And so, but I never did see the movie. It is rated, wait, let me see.
Yeah, I'm trying to find it now too. Can't quite pin it down. Searching for.
Oh, it is rated PG-13.
It's PG-13, huh? I guess.
Now, and me personally, you know, I don't worry a ton about it, but it's clear from the way the consumers are, by the sheer volume of money that PG-13 movies make compared to rated R movies, that people want to consume media that is tame in those ways, that has limits. They don't want to be shocked with blood and gore, and they don't want to be, you know, thrust into moments of awkward sexual content in the middle of a room full of people. They don't want to hear profuse swearing in front of their children. Those kinds of things, they enjoy the movie more if it's not in it. And that's clear because anytime somebody makes a movie and they want it to be a blockbuster, they have to get it rated PG-13.
Yeah, that is all true. You do hear about
all kinds of movies are released to the rating people. They get an R. They go back. They edit it.
Yep, exactly.
And then they get a PG-13 rating, and then they release it to the public. That happens frequently because they don't want the stigma of a rated R movie, which would they know limit their audience.
That is, yeah, that's really, and I'm just trying to like think about the parallels in the world of literature then too, because that's like so perfect, because in the, you know, in Hollywood, for example, because I know it's not one of those things that like just any other, you know, any old movie can just get a rating. There's like a process they have to go through, and normally it's these big production companies front to get that in there, and it's really an investment that those production companies make. And you think about the world of literature, I mean, that's, I don't know. I guess I hadn't really thought about it in these terms before.
I don't think it would cost that much. Honestly, I think you could, and I've considered this as a business. I'm not interested in making it, but mm-hmm. I thought about it. I think you could get it down to a couple $100. I could probably find readers who would read the book for $100, and I could find a way to certify those readers as being good judges of the content of a book.
Mm-hmm.
And then I could sell that as a service. And if they, you know, if they paid for this service, then they could have a little sticker on their book cover that says, you know, certified okay for 14-year-olds and up or whatever.
Yeah, that is really interesting. I guess it's, I don't know, I'm glad we're having this conversation, because I'm very much like a, it's strange to say, but I think in some ways, maybe literature to a point is one of the last, like, I don't know, maybe I'm being too grandiose about it, but it's a final bastion for sort of like anti-censorship, I guess, because it's really hard to get like a book censored or banned. You hear that come up all the time. You know, there used to be the book burnings. People talk about like censoring, you know, Mark Twain and things like that. That comes up every once in a while. But it's one of those last, it's like the last stand for people to have that sort of free speech approach. And I think it's interesting to know that though that's certainly there and valid, and it's something that I really embrace. I think that's great, and I think we definitely need that. I think you're totally spot on in the thought that there could be and would be a market for the sort of business model that you just described, too.
Well, here's another example. I was reading, at the time, it was a best-selling book,
mm-hmm.
And it was written by an associate of mine. We're not friends or anything, but I kind of knew this person, and it was a really good book, and it was 2/3 of the way through the book before it entered what I consider to be completely gratuitous sex scene.
Mm-hmm.
It was not necessary to the plot. It really wasn't ideal characterization of the people in the story. It was just kind of forced by the author.
Like, and they needed, I'm sure, a sex scene or something
like that.
Yeah.
But I didn't. I thought it was kind of poor taste. And I really would prefer not to have to, you know, like come out of the story and start cognating about these things. I just want it to be a good story.
And I think to your point, it's one of those things where if you are writing a book, if you're filming a movie, if you're making a video game that's going to have, you know, explicit content, whether it's in the realm of violence, whether it's language, whether it's sexual, I think the overall use of that really has to be organic to the story you're trying to tell. Because, for example, I mean, and correct me if I'm wrong, but do you feel you might have felt differently about that sex scene if it did fit in with characterization and plot and things of that nature? Is that something that, like, you know, would have maybe landed a bit more, for lack of a better word?
Sure. And but also, there's, just like in movies, there's a way to cut scenes that is tasteful. And there's a way to do those things without slapping someone in the face with it. And maybe, you know, that's considered prudish by some people. In fact, you get a heavy-handed group of highly liberal people who say, this is the reality. People have sex. Therefore, having sex in a book is legitimate. And they say, hey, you know, people swear. If your characters aren't swearing, they're not real characters. And I've, in several cases, had this discussion, but my response to them is always the same. People also poop, but I don't show it in my book.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose if
I'm painting something, what I put in the painting and what I leave out of it is the art. That's the message I'm giving. And it's no different in a book. What I write into my stories and what I leave out of them paints a kind of world. It has a feel to it. It has a voice. And my statement to the world comes in what I choose to look at as important and what I don't. Every day, my characters in my stories eat breakfast. I very seldom describe what they're eating or even tell anyone that they're eating. That's a boring scene. No one cares if you're munching Cheerios right after your alarm clock went off. Unless it's relevant to the character or the plot, it gets left out. And I think in some cases, those things could be relevant, as you said, but it's possible to do them tastefully and morally in such a way that it doesn't pull the readers out of the story or force them to see, you know, imagine things that really are not important. Yes, horrible things happen in life. Good things happen in life. There's a blend. But what people are really saying, in my opinion, when they write graphic horror scenes about blood and guts is different than what I would say if I was writing about a serial killer. I would, of course, talk about the results of their killing, but having people drag through those bloody scenes is a different meaning. It has a different purpose. It's a different communication. And if an author can't understand that, I feel like maybe they don't, you know, maybe they should. Maybe they should take some time to realize what they're saying with their story. World War Z said some cool things as a story, you know, and it's not appropriate for children, the things that it said. But those things that it said could be done in a PG-13 way. I don't know. Thinking of the book as I read it, it was pretty graphic. As written, it probably would have been a rated R movie.
Certainly. And I think that it's, you know, I think it's a good example to explore to a point because, you know, because of the content that it would contain naturally. I mean, anything that has an apocalyptic bent to it, I think it's hard to write an apocalyptic or a post-apocalyptic or an apocalypse is incipient sort of story without having, you know, that dark sort of material. But I think that, you know, maybe with the movie, it doesn't end up being the perfect analogy only because they did deviate so much from the text itself, if that makes sense.
Right.
And it sounds like you may not have seen the movie, but it was very, I mean, very different. I actually did not, I'll go on record and say this, I don't recommend the movie. I did not enjoy it compared to how awesome of a book it was.
And that, you know, that happens. some stories are better as books than movies, and some are better as movies than books, certainly. I feel like it's clear that what people want in a story is usually a really good story. Yeah, they want characters, they want struggles, they want meaning. And, you know, I mean, if what you want to read about is blood and guts, you can find books that are that. And if you want to read about graphic sex, you can find books that are that. But I think most of the time, they're kind of looking for a specific kind of story. And a book gets you inside a character's head in a way that no other media can.
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, just even the access to things like inner, you know, monologue or having the opportunity to explore motivation from, you know, often the first person standpoint. I mean, it really changes the dimensions through which the media is consumed, I guess.
Exactly. And, but even within that framework, people want boundaries to what they personally are interested in exploring. When, you know, I really like the TV ratings that have the SDV and or whatever on it. So it tells you if there's sexual contact, violence, drug use, or language.
Sure. Yeah. It actually goes a step further than just giving it, you know, I mean, like you'll see for movies, it's PG-13 and then there's a long description, but with the TV, at least it's just a matter of, you know, it'll be Y7 and then they add the other letters down there to specifically flesh it out in a very like concise way.
Right. And I can imagine a parent who has a 14-year-old child who, let's say, is involved with a group of people who ride skateboards all the time. And that parent decides, hey, I don't want you watching shows that depict illegal drug use as positive. Therefore, I don't want you watching shows that say TV-14 if it's a D on the bottom, as opposed to other things that parents may want to filter, or, you know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. It would be different than 14L or 14D.
I let them see everything because blah, blah, blah. And that's their choice. But I don't feel like that's the best way to raise a kid. And personally, I don't always want to see that stuff. Sometimes I just want to see a good show.
Yeah. And I think it really all comes down to, I guess, the preference of the reader or the viewer or the position that they are in a household, for example, maybe where they do have kids or what have you. I think that the key, I guess, from the standpoint that I come from, I mean, that is something that I was going to bring up, was that in real life, these things do exist. You know, graphic violence is sadly, it's out there. You see it in the news every day. You know, sex is something that is just a part of life. But like you said, you know, you're not going to write about other things in life too, whether it's eating cereal or someone that's taking a poop. But I think that for me, the key when consuming media, because I'm pretty, you know, I don't want to say indifferent to explicit content. There are some things that are, if it is so gratuitous and gratuitous for the sake of being gratuitous, that is definitely something where I'm like, all right, whether it's an author or a director or a screenwriter, it's like, we could have done better here. Because for me, the key to a good story is that it is of itself. You know, the events that occur, whether they end up taking an explicit route or not, they need to be organic. They need to be true to the world, and they need to be true to the characters. And for me, I guess that's kind of what my guideline is, I guess. I feel like, you know, I certainly come, I think, probably from a different perspective than you do on the matter. But at the same time, I think it really comes down to, you know, what it is you're looking to enjoy as a consumer of that media, and at the same time, whether or not it rises from the organic action of the story itself.
Right. And I'm certainly not saying there isn't a place for all those medias that people want, and I'm not trying, we're not on a crusade to, you know, to try and like change other people to our way of thinking, but since we are in a position to choose, we looked at what we think people want and said, hey, let's choose to do this. It's no different than a company saying, we're going to publish middle grade stories and we don't want any bad words in there.
Yeah, right? Exactly. I mean, yeah.
If you want to publish a story with bad words, you just go to a different publisher. It's like dating. You find someone that matches what you want.
Well, and I think that's what makes it, I think that's what's great about it too, is like you said, you know, it isn't about, it sounds like it's, you know, it's really not about a crusade. It's really about there's a market for this. It's something that you believe in, and it's something that you enjoy, you know, consuming yourself. So why not provide that as an environment for readers to know, you know, from the get go, for example. And I think that's really great because it's in an age where I think there's a lot of, you know, I think it just inherently, whether, and I'll speak specifically to the United States in general, we do have a really polarized environment, whether it's politically or culturally, depending on the region in which you're in. I think it's great to have, you know, outlets where we know that we can be okay with the media that we're consuming. But at the same time, you know, once in a while, it's good to push yourself too. But if you know what you're getting into as you go into it, I think they can better prepare yourself, you know, and frame the media you're consuming in such a way that you know, hey, I'm going to do this because it's something that I will enjoy as entertainment, or hey, this is something I'm going to read because I think I'd like to push myself a little bit to see what else is out there, if that makes sense.
Right, exactly. And we don't imagine in any world that there's going to be people who will only read our books.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And we do imagine, as you suggested, that there will be people who might say, hey, I want to buy a book from this company because I know what I'm getting.
Yeah, absolutely. And now I'm thinking about another example too, even where you think about something that has enjoyed great commercial success, despite, its graphic content, is a show like Game of Thrones. You know, that is if you've read the books or if you watch the show, I mean, it is just a great story. It's a very vivid world, but it also has these very dark themes and events surrounding it. And there have been times where there'll be people that, you know, I kind of pitch it to, I walk them through it, and they're really interested. And I had one friend in particular who she thought it sounded really great to get into, but she just knew that, you know, that kind of violence just wasn't her thing. And she said, it's probably a great show, and I'd really like to be, I'd like to watch it, but for her, the violence was too much, and so she knew she wouldn't watch it. So, I mean, it's the market's there if people want to get into that too, but if you know what you're getting into when you get into it, then you know how to evaluate it for yourself based on your own taste.
Right, exactly. And it's not, and I feel like this is a conversation that people, it's important, but they don't have this conversation enough. People don't really, not everyone. There's some people who are just, they believe in just heading towards whatever they want at full speed, and that's great. But for example, another example that goes with this issue is the recent success of the Deadpool movie. Way back in the 90s, I collected Deadpool comics that were definitely PG-13.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt the humor at that time was exceptional. It was very funny. It was a really great piece of character work. And so I enjoyed those a lot. And to have later, to have Ryan Reynolds say, oh no, this is what Deadpool should be like, was, in my opinion, wrong. He saw a different side of that character. And obviously enough people agreed with him that the movie was very successful, but I didn't have any interest in it because what I liked in that character was not the extreme violence and adult themes, which didn't exist at the time. Mm-hmm. What I liked about that character was the dark aspects and how he always dealt with it. Even though he had dark humor, he dealt with it using humor. And I think that message was a lot more poignant. At least I imagine it.
It was, you know, perhaps not as maybe clouded by some of the other things that the film incorporated, for example.
Right. And I know there are a lot of fans of that film, and I'm not trying to say that they're wrong. They have what they want. But I'm saying there's a lot of people who don't always want to have that issue in front of them when they're consuming media. Look at the success of the Avengers movies. There's some violence, there's a little bit of language, but they're relatively clean. They're very funny, they're highly appealing, they're great entertainment.
Yeah, that's true.
Sometimes that's all I want. I just want to go get some entertainment.
Yeah, I mean, I think it comes down to, it kind of comes full circle back to the whole, there are opportunities and there are ways to be successful, you know, whether it's commercially or just even as an individual who, you know, is trying to write content that appeals to them. There are ways to be successful going either way, I guess. It really just comes down to emphasis and interpretation and just ultimately personal preference.
Right, and I really don't. My preference is not to acquire books where authors have written a story and then they've edited or censored it to try and get published by us. That is definitely not our goal. We are trying to find people who, similar to us, want to tell these stories in a way that appeals to a wider range of ages without respect for the age of the main character. It taps into all these issues of censorship, I guess, but it's really not meant as a censorship thing. It's meant as a, this is what we like kind of art, you know, we like this state, these books. And if you write these books, we want to give you a venue to get them out into the world.
Yeah, it becomes a lot less about censorship and just more about expectations for both the reader and, you know, even the individual that's writing, for example. And I think that is really, I think that that's something that's really important to me too, just as a writer. If I were going to have a book published, I understand that there are certain things, you know, that you got to work on in your scenes and all that, but I would never want to censor or, you know, pare back my content if I felt like it wasn't true to the book, because at the same time, it comes back to that idea of having something that's organic. You know, if it just feels right as the writer that you need to use certain words in certain contexts, or if it feels right that that sex scene needs to be presented in a particular way, that might just be how you need to tell the story. And I think that that's, you know, like you've said earlier, that's all fine and good. It's just not going to be the right match. And so you keep playing the dating game and you find a place that it works for you.
Oh yeah. And frankly, what we're publishing is not commonly published by most people.
Mm-hmm.
Most people look at a book, for example, with an 8-year-old protagonist that's written for adults, and they won't touch it. Publishers hate that stuff now.
Yeah.
It's really hard to sell a publisher on a mismatch of age, which I think is ridiculous. Honestly, if you can imagine that you're in a gothic horror, mm-hmm. and then why can't you imagine that you're a 300-year-old vampire? Why does the age of the vampire affect who's the person reading the book? It doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
In fact, there's evidence to suggest that books without that limitation do better in some cases.
Yeah, because I was going to say, for example, you have a book like Room by Emma Donoghue, which was, if you're familiar with that one, I believe it was also made into a movie. But that was told from the perspective of a 5-year-old kid who grew up in this world where all he knew was this room that he lived in with his mom. And to the reader, it's very apparent that something dark is going on here. And in fact, you know, the mother was kidnapped at some point, and she has been kept in this room for years. And he is, in fact, you know, sort of the offspring of the man that kidnapped her. He doesn't know any better. And that book was tremendously successful, obviously enough to be made into a movie. And I also feel that it was presented in such a way that you could read that book and not encounter anything that was gratuitous, because it's told from the perspective of that child. So they don't have an understanding. They don't have the framework. They don't have the wherewithal to understand how truly dark their situation is. And in fact, it's something that they never quite realize over the course of the book, though they certainly grow as the circumstances change. So it's, I don't know. It's interesting. It's, again, I think there's room out there for both. It really just depends on, you know, catching the, sometimes you just got to win the lottery, you know, kind of like we said earlier with some of that other stuff. It's sometimes books just win the lottery and sometimes they don't. It all depends on right place, right time, and right presentation.
Oh yeah. And having, when I was unpublished and mm-hmm. I was trying to find someone to publish my books, you feel a kind of desperation, because you're just like, why won't anybody see the brilliance in my work? But after you get published and some of that angst goes away, I came to see that it really is like dating. It's actually a bigger tragedy to marry someone that isn't the right person for you than to break up with them, just like in dating. And so it's actually a bigger tragedy to get your book published by the wrong press in some ways, because for reasons that are outside of the scope of this conversation, but
no, but it makes perfect sense. And I'm actually, it's really kind of refreshing and reassuring to hear that, because as an individual who at this time is unpublished, but is actively, you know, working on polishing a manuscript, getting ready to pitch this one, as I did with a book a few years ago, that is something that's good to keep in mind. I think that's something that's valuable to writers anywhere, is that no matter what venue you choose to try and publish through, or who you choose to pitch through, it doesn't necessarily need to be like, here I am begging for exposure, please tell the world my story. You just got to wait for the right time and the right person and make it work. Because you don't want to, it can go one of two ways. You don't want to shackle yourself, or like you said, you don't want to marry into a relationship that isn't going to work for you, but you also don't want to, you know, think that because it doesn't work out the first time that you're going to spend your life toiling away as a, you know, quote unquote, single unpublished author or something along those lines.
Well, it's true, but, and this kind of brings us back full circle. The truth is, even when you get published, except for a very few people who you know, hit the New York Times bestseller list and can quit their day job. Mm-hmm. For the most of us, and by most, I mean like 99.999%.
Yep.
If you really need some intrinsic reason to be writing.
Mm-hmm.
Rewards that are central to yourself, which are rewarding enough to keep you going, regardless of the money or the number of readers or whether a publisher, you know, experiences your work. And if that happens, you will continue to write and become good enough to publish.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, it's that sense of, I've said the word probably way too many times for a single podcast, but it's that organic sort of, your story has to be organic, and so do your motivations for sitting down to write. Because if you're a writer that has to write versus someone who likes the idea of writing, you will write, you will continue to write, you will continue to improve, and eventually you'll find your place.
Oh, yeah. And Ray Bradbury said it takes 1,000,000 words.
That's a lot of words. That's a lot of work to put in, and you got to be ready to do it.
And, you know, that actually came true in my case.
I had
written 12 books before one got published.
Wow. I mean, that's like perfect then.
What? It's 1,000,000 words. I mean, it just takes that long to find your voice and to work through. I mean, because if you think about it, you write a whole book, that's only one data point.
Yep. Yep.
And you have, in order to figure out a progress, you have to write many books, and they take absurdly long to write.
Mm-hmm.
Compared to like if you were playing tennis, where you could work on your swing in one session with a coach. Books take a lot longer to write. Stories are huge time takers. And so, you know, it's something that you have to have reasons to do it that propel you. And then eventually, whether it's your first book or your 10th book or whatever, you get to the point where you match with someone and the press says, hey, we want this as part of our lineup. And we think that people will buy this.
And then they all live happily ever after, right? That's how it ends.
Well, most of the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
The author's really excited, and then they sell less than they think they should. And then they get back on the social media and they start to boost their sales, and then they write another book, and then mm-hmm. feels like that.
It's one of those things where like people, again, to tie it into like the dating and relationships thing, it's like there are far too many people out there who are like, yeah, marriage is like this finish line. I'll get there and I'll be married and everything, I'll be happy. And it's like, well, there's some adjustments involved there, I'm sure. And there's a lot of work that goes into it after that. So I don't know. It's just kind of a parallel for, there it is again, writing is a parallel for life in general.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And the thing I tell a lot of people, and it's actually in our self-edit guide, right after we sign the contract, we send to our authors a self-editing guide to do their first run-through.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing it says is, getting a book published is more work after you sign the contract than before.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. It's one of those things that I think about now, even as, you know, I've been working on this particular manuscript. I've been taking it more seriously for like the last, I would say, 2 years. But every time I finish a draft, I recognize that was the easy part. Going in and editing, that takes way more time. Getting your story right, tweaking the plot, all that jazz, just to make it presentable. So I can imagine that even, you know, that amount of editing can't be anything compared to what it is once you've actually signed a contract.
Right. And it's also great. I mean, editing with an editor, you know, after a contract is its own thing. It's a whole new way of editing. Because, you know, you have friends, they read it, they tell you stuff, you change mm-hmm. it. You work on it as well as you can, but it's like a whole nother skill set, which is fun.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. I mean, it's like, it adds an element, I guess, of teamwork too, especially if you have an editor with which like you feel very comfortable and have an opportunity to collaborate on a very, you know, peers sort of level, I guess.
Oh, definitely. And it can be hard to find such an editor. Not, I don't know. I think there are editors and authors who don't mesh, but for the most part, you know, it doesn't take very many tries to find a good editor.
And at the end of the day, everyone realistically is on the same team. You know, it's, I think right. that as long as everyone has in mind the fact that you're trying to make the best book possible, whether you're the author or the editor or the agent that's going to represent it, I mean, it's, you want to tell the best story that you can. So, you know, the editor might say a scene doesn't work. You got to be ready to kill that darling once in a while. That's just how it's going to be. So
true. Mm-hmm. Although honestly, I feel like small presses in some ways are better because everybody working on the book is doing it out of a sense of love for the creation of book process.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't worked with a big press specifically, but you know, if somebody's editing your book for what turns out to be relatively small money, that they're doing it out of a sense of, you know, dedication to literature in general. And that has its own kind of awesome.
Yeah, it's a separate sort of like synergy. You know, there's more of like a bond around it then.
Right. It's like a local garage band who gets a gig at a little place and for the first time they're playing for an audience. There's a kind of energy to that that is not repeatable in any other circumstance.
No, I think that's really good. That's a very, I think, apt metaphor. Yeah.
It's great. It's worth getting to. I highly recommend it to all my author friends. As I tell them, you know, just keep writing. Just put out that fifth book. It's going to happen. You just can't fixate on allowing a publisher to validate you.
Yep.
You have to have other reasons for writing. And then if the publisher validates you, it's freaking awesome.
And then everyone wins. That's synergy. There's high fives, et cetera.
There it is.
Yeah. Oh, perfect. So I guess then, wrapping up a little bit here, what can we look forward to from Immortal Works in 2017 and beyond?
Oh, we have a fantastic lineup coming. Our next book coming out is Dawn's Hill by Corinne Larinaga.
Mm-hmm.
And she is, and it's kind of a fun little dark ghost story kind of thing. And we've got some sci-fi. We've got an MG by Carl Hackman that we recently signed.
Mm-hmm.
And I've just been really excited by the wide range of stories that fit within what we're trying to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I was looking at, you know, I was doing some tinkering around again on the website today too, and I saw Corinne's upcoming book, and I remember the first time I visited it too, I saw that book from Ryan DeCaria that's going to be out at some point, I would guess this year, just based on the fact that it's out there, and that seemed like a really neat premise too, so it's very cool to see that, you know, you folks started up not all that long ago, all things considered, and there's already, things are moving along.
Oh, it actually kind of shocked me how quickly it all just it came together. And then we had a ton of submissions and a bunch of them were fantastic. And we've got everything from, you know, a kind of pure fantasy to pure sci-fi to we've got a historical fiction coming. It's fantastic.
Well, that's awesome. I'll definitely keep an eye out for it. And like I said, too, if you guys ever have authors or anything like that, you know, you think would be a good fit for the podcast, I'm always willing to sit down and talk genre, talk craft, whatever the case might be. You're always welcome to come on back.
Awesome. I think we'll take you up on that deal.
Well, that sounds good. Thanks a lot, James, for being with me, and I'm sure we'll talk again soon.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
There you have it, another interview in the books. Thanks again to James Wymore, and an additional shout out to the Immortal Works publicist, Corinne Larinaga, for helping organize this month's episode. So since we recorded this one earlier in January, I have had an opportunity to think about some of the content of our conversation, for example, and I should say more specifically, about why we don't show characters necessarily using the bathroom or eating cereal, to borrow the examples that James used. And I think that there's a lot of validity in the overall point being made, but I do think that making a direct comparison between using the bathroom and things like sex scenes or scenes which incorporate violence is not necessarily applicable. And that's mostly because scenes centered around sex or violence generally, and I think just by their nature, they're going to involve multiple characters and opportunities for conflict and growth, which I'm not entirely sure the same can be said for the examples that we discussed over the course of our conversation. That being said, though, whether you're going to incorporate a sex scene, whether you're going to incorporate a scene that features violence or obscene language, to James' point, it really is all about presentation in the end. So if you're writing something like that, my advice is, number one, as always, consult your characters. Does it make sense for your characters? Consult your story. Does it make sense for your story? Consult yourself. You're the writer at the end of the day. You know what's best for your story. You should know what's best for your characters. Well, realistically, they should know what's best for themselves. Trust them to guide the action on the page. Trust yourself to know how to present it in a way that makes sense for the story you're trying to tell. And remember that being edgy for the sake of being edgy only accomplishes one thing, which is being edgy. As writers, I think we need to encourage ourselves to strive to do more, be multidimensional with our writing, and be conscious of what we're really saying with our words. The same holds true not only in writing, but in life as well. That being said, I'll tuck my soapbox away until next time and bid farewell for now. Stay tuned for the March episode of the R.R. Campbell Writes Cast, which will feature YA author Josh Springs. And as always, write on and write well.